Wait a random in.
Committee on Judiciary order. Today is April 9th, 2009. First item on the agenda is a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3218. Open a public hearing.
House Bill 3218 directs the Department of Corrections to establish on-the-job training programs for offenders released from corrections facilities. It allows the department to enter into agreements with public and private employers to provide the training. It sunsets January 2012, declares an emergency, and has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We do have a fiscal issued on this. It estimates $2.6 million for the next biennium and then $660,000 for 2011 through 13.
Okay, Janet Carlson and Chris Marfin.
Good afternoon. Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. I'll speak to the fiscal impact, which I had not seen before, and it's a little bit of a surprise to me as I go through the bill. But I just wanted to give a little bit of an introduction, and then Chris Marfin is actually the expert on how the program works. We had six bills that we introduced. Representative Cameron introduced them this session on reentry. We've talked to you before about those issues, so I won't take your time today to talk about kind of the concept behind it, that we need to have strategies in order to help folks overcome barriers as they reintegrate back into the community. This bill was the result of a work group that took a look at some of the best practices and strategies that we were doing around our area in particular. And Chris, who works at Chemeketa Community College, has been managing a pilot program in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties, right? Three counties? That uses Workforce Investment Act money and does this very program in Marion County. So she has some statistics to provide you on the success of the program. The way the bill is structured and the way that we envision it working would be, first of all, that we have the Department of Corrections establishing the on-the-job training program as a pilot program. There was some question from the community corrections directors about why the Department of Corrections would be the one to establish it. In my view, as I understand the law, you need a state agency to sort of be the point from where dollars flow in, administrative rules get created, and then it can go down to the counties, and the counties can actually do the work on the ground. That is what is anticipated in the bill. However, there are a couple counties, Douglas, I believe, and Lynn, that have opted out of actually administering community corrections. So in that instance where the bill says department or county, if Douglas County, for example, wanted to run an on-the-job training program, the Department of Corrections would actually be the one to manage that program and contract locally because they are state employees that work in Douglas County as an opt-out county. On the second page of the bill are some of the parameters and policies, and we actually tried to scale down as much as possible the specifics and allow the Department of Corrections to actually establish those administrative rules. I'm not a real big fan of putting a whole lot of detail about how a program works in statute, because then if things don't work out and you want to change it, we're back here again next session trying to do that. However, the concept behind the program is that an employer would get a training stipend in order to train someone who is coming to work for that employer. That gives that employer an incentive to hire someone that perhaps might not be as skilled as they ought to be in going into the job. The rules that we have around our program in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County require, I think, a full-time job, and on this particular bill, in talking to the folks that run community corrections, they believe that having people get their foot in the door with even a half-time or part-time job, 20 hours a week, would be really valuable. The other idea is that if that person comes in and there's that training stipend, it will be an incentive to the employer to retain that employee for a length of time, which also is good for the employee, as that employee can get those skills and that on-the-job experience that can then allow them to step into a subsequent job if that job were to be over. We do have on lines 14 and 15 that the rules should be consistent with the Federal Workforce Investment Act, because if those funds are available in a community, we don't want the federal and the state to be at odds with each other if you could use those dollars in implementing the program. And then finally, the two key lines in this bill are lines 16 and 17. which I worked with legislative counsel to find the right language. The department may seek funding through grants and other means to carry out the on-the-job training program for ex-offenders established under this section. Understanding what the economic climate was going into session, and it's becoming worse by day by day, we did not anticipate that there would actually be any general fund that would go along with this bill. That there would be. I'm going to a meeting tomorrow where we're looking at stimulus money as a possible funding source for this type of program to continue it and add this population to it in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. So it's optional whether or not general fund even funds it. The bill does not specify that it be statewide. It says it's a pilot program. It could begin with one region, one county, as many counties as funding would allow. So I'm not sure where the $2.6 million came from. Maybe the estimate was assuming that all counties would do it. We're not even sure how many employers out there would hire folks, you know, so there's really a lot of question marks in terms of assumptions that are made to develop a fiscal impact for this bill. And we do understand it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so I imagine they would work out all of those gory details, but just wanted to put that on the record. So with that, I'll conclude and turn it over to Chris to give you the real information about how the program works.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair Parker and committee members. My name is Chris Murfin. I work with Chemeketa Community College in the Workforce Integration Department. And we have many funding sources in our department. One of the larger funding sources is the WIA, Adult and Dislocated Youth. That is where the funding sources that we run our current OJT program out of. The OJT program actually goes back to the days of JTPA, and at that time we found that the program was quite cumbersome to employers, a lot of paperwork. So 2 years ago we simplified the program, made it much more streamlined for employers, and I've provided you today with a handout that shows some of the statistics in Marion County and the response that we've gotten from employers after we took a look at the paperwork and streamlined the program. The program essentially allows employers to start a new employee and have assistance with training and any loss of productivity they might find in hiring and retraining and training a new employee. I became involved in working with this population around 3 years ago, and I work with job seekers who have multiple barriers to employment, and this is a hard to serve population, and especially right now in this economy anyways. So what we noticed in working with job seekers in our resource rooms is we were seeing more and more people with criminal histories and reentering the community from prison. And having identified those and looking at what the needs were to help this population, because people with criminal histories and coming out of prisons into the community really have to market themselves differently in job searching, and it's a little bit more work for them than the other job seekers out there that are also applying for the same jobs as they are. So we've come up with some things, an incarceration speech, helping a person be with a criminal history be prepared to answer the question, tell me about your criminal history, teaching them how to answer the question on the application, do you have a criminal history or do you have a felony? Those are really two different questions, and so we've tried to provide some guidance to this population. The OJT program will allow staff that are out there working with employers and doing some job development to have an extra tool in their tool belt, really, and when they're marketing programs and these folks that we're working with criminal histories, they have one more option to give employers. Through the program that we've ran in Marion County that I've provided the statistics on, we have had a great response since we've streamlined our paperwork. I won't go through each of these statistics with you, but I'm definitely available and interested in answering any questions that you might have. I do believe that House Bill 3218 will assist individuals reentering the community by providing an incentive to employers to give them a supportive employment opportunity. We've worked with SEDCOR as part of this, and they're willing and able and out there marketing offenders and the OJT program to employers, as well as some of the staffing agencies are on board and helping us to also serve this population in providing gainful employment and therefore assisting us in reducing the recidivism rate around incarceration.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the work that you all are doing, and Commissioner Carlson, particularly for bringing this forward. Just a couple of questions. On the Marion County program results, I wanted to ask you about retention. It says 80% retention rate. Does that mean if they've stayed one day past the training point, they would be counted as retained, or do you have any stats, for example, of how many people were still working at the company 6 months after the training ended or a year after the training ended?
These statistics were as of February 28th, and so the way that we issue the reimbursements to the employer is that they hire a person on, and after they've kept them through that training period, which is normally 3 months, they get the first check of $1,000, and then they they're hired. The person is hired, and after a 3 month retention, then they are offered the other $1,000 check. What the retention rate on here represents is those that were still employed at their OJT training site as of February 28th.
Follow up. So the second payment is when they're actually on the company's payroll as a regular employee. That's when they get the second installment.
Correct.
For 3 months.
For 3 months,
they've been
yes.
There. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Okay, further questions, Representative Stigler.
Yeah, and I want to preface this by saying I applaud these series of efforts that we've had, but I've begun to get some feedback from folks in my community, particularly in these economic times, the displacement of programs such as these of other displaced workers. And that's a hard one for me to. I mean, I'm all for giving people a second, you know, second leg up and a second chance and all of that. But it's a very difficult question for me to respond to them, because I can't sit there and say, when I've got, you know, data that shows somebody else is getting a job because perhaps there are these not preferences, but there are these additional incentives to an employer to hire, you know, this group of folks. So, you know, how is this played out in the employment community in your, you know, in your counties?
I'll start. Maybe Chris can add something, and I really appreciate that, because that is the issue that we're dealing with.
Really,
in fact, we're working on hosting a community-wide breakfast this fall for the faith and business leaders to kind of talk about the whole issue. Do we really believe that people can change? And I think that the issue that it really gets down to is, if you have two people, one has a criminal history and one does not, and they're equally qualified, who do you hire? Or if you have two people, one who's more qualified with a criminal history and one who's less, who do you hire? And right now, as I understand it, the playing field treats everyone with a criminal history. I mean, oftentimes they don't even get screened in for a review of the application because of the policies. And so what we're really up against is not trying to have preferences, and I know that language kind of floats around, and I've dealt with that in my community as well as a county commissioner. But what you're looking at is making sure that we're actually treating everyone as an individual human being, as opposed to stereotyping someone because they have a criminal history as all being at the lowest common denominator. And I think we all understand that there are folks coming out of prison that are going to go back in and are not ready, and, you know, it's going to not be productive to push those folks into jobs. But we do have people who have gone through every treatment program, have really, you know, done everything that they've been asked to do, and they still can't get a job because they have that criminal record. And those are the folks, those highly motivated, skilled people that we're trying to convince employers to go past their prejudices and take a chance.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
That's not really getting to the core of my question, because I think people, at least on some level, understand that issue.
Mm-hmm.
The issue that they see is that quite the opposite is going to occur in these situations if there's a financial incentive for an employer to hire the ex-offender as versus the dislocated worker from within the community who mm-hmm. may have maybe lesser, is in the same job skills area, but that there's this incentive to hire on the ex-offender, give them on-the-job training, and, as versus this guy who's been a hard-working citizen all their life and had no problems. So, I mean, I think that's a hard one to sort of
right.
sell
if
out
there. Right, if that's plays out, maybe Chris, you can...
Yes. In the subsidized employment programs that we have, and this is one of a few, we definitely make sure that we stay within the guidelines of federal labor laws. So if we had two individuals that were applying for a position with an employer, and only one was eligible for OJT and one was not, that is not an appropriate use. These have to be newly created positions, that would be eligible for the OJT program. So an employer cannot list a regular job that they were going to hire, and then somebody comes through the door and advertise that, say, in the IMATCH system, the employment department system, and be recruiting for an unsubsidized position, and then somebody comes through the door that's eligible for the OJT program, like an offender. They cannot then switch that program to an OJT. They cannot switch that job to an OJT. They have to hire the position they were already going to hire for, and they would need to create a new position for the OJT. So the OJT programs, subsidized employment programs, are not meant to displace any regular employees or new positions that they have. Or if we had an employer that had a massive layoff, we would not then be able to turn around and fill their workplace with 10 OJT people. So that is something that we're looking for and talking with employers about.
Sort of continuing along those lines, I understand that, but these positions, I guess what I need some clarification of, these OJT positions, are they in a very narrow class that the only OJT, the only person who would qualify for those funds is an ex-offender as versus a general person from the community?
No, I think what we're asking for in House Bill 3218 is to add a OJT program specifically for offenders reentering the community. And in addition to that, we will continue to operate our program under the Adult and Dislocated Worker Programs of the Workforce Investment Act, which do serve any person unemployed walking into any of our WorkSource Oregon centers across the state.
Right. One point of follow-up,
please.
Okay. And you just hit, at the beginning of that answer, you hit, I think, the area that people have the most trouble with. This is a program that 3218 is a program specifically designed for ex-offenders. OJT, that's what you said. And that's what I want to be really clear about.
And I apologize. Maybe I'm not being clear.
You said what?
We are asking for a number of OJT slots that would be specifically for offenders, in addition to the slots that we currently have for adult and dislocated workers. So, both the general population would be served and the offender population.
But with respect to those reserved for the ex-offenders, nobody but an ex-offender would be qualified for those OJT slots. Correct?
I believe it was an ex-offender or a person with a criminal history.
That's what I'm saying. It's
yes.
That narrow. Okay.
Yes.
I just wanted to be really clear about that.
Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I appreciate this bill. It's similar to the things we've been talking about for 2 or 3 years regarding meth and that type of thing. And, the recovery programs, employment, and housing are the things that have been identified that reduce recidivism. And I applaud all this and really support it. I was kind of struck a little bit by the word of ex-offender 10 times. I know what a released offender is. I know what a past offender is. I know what an ex-inmate is. I don't think you ever get rid of being an offender. You still are an offender, but you're in a different state after you serve your you're due. I don't know if it's the right word, if there's some definition somewhere, but it seems kind of strange that you refer to them that way when, you know, you're painted black with that brush, you don't ever get unpainted. You still are an offender.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with that, and I think that we struggle to come up with a term that we then use across the board. I absolutely agree with that.
Representative Cameron. Mr. Chair, I want to thank Chris and the Commissioner for being here today. And I understand, as a sponsor of this bill, I understand the fiscal situation that we're in. But the series of bills that and the work that's been done here locally, the community here understands the need for everybody to be fully employed and to have jobs. And the issue here that we're trying to do is truly about a quality of life and an economic situation here, because in Marion County we understand the fact that there are things that we need to help these people in some way. And I, as we're just talking here off the side, I'm not sure what the answer is, but hopefully this is raising an issue that we need to continue to have a conversation about. Truly, people make mistakes. Truly, people go to prison. Truly, people, there are some that come out that have not changed, but people change. And we need to find ways to try to help them, as well as help those people who have lost their jobs. To say we can do one and not the other, I think, is not the right approach. And so I really want to appreciate the work that's done here locally to actually demonstrate how it is being done locally. And the businesses here in Marion County, many of them get the vision, and many of them understand that, yes, we want to employ good people, and we want to give these people a good chance and get them out of a system that is very costly and make them, help them be productive citizens and be actually contributing to our society. And I thank you for your work that you're doing in that area.
Thank you. And again, I support the effort, too. I've had some pushback from people saying we got veterans coming back from the National Guard that are having trouble finding work. But we need to get everybody back to work as best we can.
Can I add? I apologize. Commander Jeff Wood was not able to be here today. He was here last week, and so he did want his testimony passed
out. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I appreciate it. Again, I'm really impressed with the work that you did. I did similar work in Portland for Better People, the organization that I started. I just wanted to let you all know that I'll be supporting sending this on to Ways and Means, but I wanted to get some things on the record similar to my concerns about having a tax credit approach with employers. And it's just that while I support the bill, I think we do need to be careful that we're actually giving an incentive to people to change their behavior and the employer to actually take a risk on somebody, as opposed to having them say, particularly low-wage employers who say, yeah, I'm hiring from this pool anyway, I'd be happy to take the OJT dollars and for hiring somebody that I already would. It also has the potential of kind of placing a downward pressure on wages. And but just expressing those concerns, we can deal with those issues more in Ways and Means. I think get it on down there and maybe figure out if the approach is, can be modified or if this is the right one. But we can have those discussions down there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3218. Open a work session on House Bill 3218.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3218 to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I will give this a courtesy yes, but I do have some concerns.
Thank you. Representative Cameron moves House Bill 3218. With a due pass, subsequent referral of Ways and Means. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I do support this bill and the concept of it, I find the fiscal troubling, and I'm prepared to give it a courtesy, too, so it can go to Ways and Means. But I fear it will die there. But given the cost-benefit analysis, even though I support this, were I on Ways and Means, I don't think I this is something I would choose to invest our scarce resources in at this particular time. I don't know if that means I should vote no now or courtesy vote later or now. And but
if you vote any way you would like, if you want to vote no to
thank you, Mr.
Put that. I mean, if you want, if you would care to vote no to call people's attention to that fact.
Perhaps I've accomplished that to an extent. Perhaps the chair might, if he has any sentiments on what would be appropriate in this procedure.
Representative Smith.
Yeah, and as I communicated with Representative Cameron, I think I'm a no on this bill. I'd be a yes to a referral with no recommendation, but I can't vote for a due pass with the rationale I gave before. Just the overall accretion of tax breaks generally. I actually think this is not an inappropriate place for, as I communicated with Representative Cameron, for us to consider tax breaks, given that a lot of the people that hire, that the employers who hire recently incarcerated people are performing a public service, and knowing that now we're spending 43.5% of the state budget on a potential state general fund on tax breaks and expenditures, whereas in 1995 to 1997 that was 32%. And that delta is $2.4 billion. The more times I say that, the harder it is for me to not feel like a hypocrite if I then, you know, too easily vote for additional tax breaks. So I'll be a no vote or a yes vote to a no recommendation motion.
Mr. Chair, I want to be clear. I don't believe this is a tax break. It's an on-the-job training program. So just want to make sure that it's...
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, Representative Barton, if you have some concerns, it's perfectly fine for you to vote no. In fact, I would encourage it. And I think we still have the votes to get it to Ways and Means. That's my sense of the committee. So I think people should vote their conscience, and then we can deal with it at Ways and Means.
You're thinking the tax credit.
I want to remove everything I said on the record a moment ago, Mr. Chair, and say that I think this bill is very interesting, and I plan on voting in favor of it, and would like to apply everything I said to another bill that I also find interesting in a different way, and say thank you to the good Representative Cameron for bringing it forward, and also you're welcome to the people watching for the brief moment of entertainment that you provided.
Representative Krieger.
I'd like to state that I'm not an attorney and I am not confused.
Oh, touche.
No.
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Enthusiastically, yes.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Yes.
Vice Chair
Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Bill moves to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make sure that Representative Barton knows that the chair, just like Santa Claus, has a good and bad list that you keep over here.
Open a...
I was on that list a long time ago, Representative.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 3299.
House Bill 3299 modifies theft in the first degree to include theft of agricultural property from land designated for farm use, and we do not yet have the fiscal impact statement on this bill.
Thank you. Yeah. Jeff Stone, Sean Cleave, and Dan Norris, please. Mr. Stone, you go ahead and kick us off here.
Oh. Mr. Chair, Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'm pleased to be before you today and wish to commend Representative Clem, Hannah, and Senator Ferrioli for helping us write this bill. It's an important effort to try to tackle the prevalent problem of agricultural theft. 3 years ago, the Oregon Farm Bureau, the Oregon Association of Nurseries, and then Marion County Sheriff Raul Ramirez met to talk about agricultural theft. At the time, it was about metal theft and agricultural theft. But at that particular point in time, metal theft was really a big problem, and so we took the road of addressing metal theft first. And so there are people on your own committee here who have been very helpful on that, and so I'd like to call out, you know, obviously they know who they are, but Representatives Olson and Barton and yourself, Mr. Chair. There is still a crossroad that we did not take to talk about agricultural theft, so I just want to take a second to talk to you and the committee about that. The fiscal impact on the nursery and greenhouse industry is in the hundreds of thousands of dollars every year. And it's just not the plant material costs. It's damage to irrigation pipe when people drive across our farm land. It's tossing aside containers to get to what they want. It's cutting through fence. It's damaging a whole host of properties and parts of the property. And nursery and greenhouse industries, those type of thefts can be rare bamboo, Christmas trees, or what was very popular just this last couple years is Japanese maples. Those plants can be anywhere between between $50 and $125 per plant, and each event could be between $600 and $5,000 in aggregate cost to the grower. Much like metal theft was a couple years ago, my growers were just internalizing these costs as a cost of doing business. But they have grown increasingly frustrated, especially in a market now that is tighter. We ship 81% of our material outside this state, and it's a billion-dollar industry. So it does mean something to the bottom line of the grower. One example is Countryside Nursery in Aurora. They were hit numerous times, and in fact, they went out to go fill customer orders, and they could not fill them because they didn't know, because they were in a certain part of the nursery. It's not like the confines of the state cattle. Think of it in terms of acres and acres. You go out to a certain field, and you can't fill that order. That's a problem when you have relationships with customers. This bill is a first step to address the very real problem of agricultural theft. I want to be clear that we're not seeking to create a felony on a kid who goes out to an apple orchard and steals an apple or a handful of cherries or whatnot. Clearly, that type of law enforcement needs to take care of itself, and so it's not clear the intent of at least the nursery and I think the people up here to prosecute those people in that manner. But regardless if it's a fruit stand, a Christmas tree, farm, or a nursery, this has very real cost to my members. So we're committed to work with our district attorney friends, with the Oregon Farm Bureau, people who support or oppose this legislation, to try to get at very meaningful efforts on this matter. So I thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to lead us off.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'll just quickly back clean up for Mr. Stone. One of the things that is growing in prevalence for the Farm Bureau members, especially those who operate U-Pick operations, is the clients will come to the farms, become familiar with the points of access and the hours of operation. And we, just last summer, have seen incidences just in West Salem here where three rows of peaches were cleaned out overnight. That would be ripe peaches and not so ripe peaches. Can't really tell in the dark what they are. But the assumption is that these are being taken to Saturday markets and being sold because somebody's not going home and canning that much peaches in their kitchen. It is a big impact, and many of my members have, as OEN's members, have built in these incidences as a cost of doing business. The interaction with law enforcement has unfortunately not yielded an interest to really tackle the issue. And unlike metal theft, there is no point of entrance where there might be a transaction to find somebody with a stolen commodity like you would with metal. and a scrap dealer. So there are some limited avenues for enforcement within the confines of the law for something like this, and we felt that addressing it through the Theft 1 statute was the most appropriate. If you're familiar with the statute, there are other mechanisms that qualify for ag-type theft, namely for livestock, and we feel this is the appropriate place to address the issue.
Chair Barker, I don't know if protocol, I see Representative, I'm Dan Norris, the DA from Niagara County, but I say I'm interrupting Representative Crager.
No, that's fine.
Okay, we'll have questions when we have
Chair. I'm sorry.
I'm Dan Norris. I'm the district attorney in Malheur County, Oregon, and I'm president of ODAA. And presently, we're neutral on the bill just because of our concern that it's presently written. It could conceivably allow a constituent in our communities to come up and say, I found him stealing an apple in my orchard, and the legislature has said that it is a felony. Do your job. But we're not opposed to the concept because this is a real problem in our communities. I see that the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association have weighed in, and they have a good argument in that it's giving them special protection. But I disagree with the policy argument to some extent because we already give special protection to some producers. If you steal a livestock animal, doesn't matter what the value is. That is a felony because livestock producers, as well as nursery persons and the farm producers and the orchardists, are especially vulnerable. They don't have the ability to really protect their crop from theft because many times they live in town and the farms and ranches are out of town. And livestock animals are defined very broadly. Flightless birds, that basically could be a chicken, which has a $15 or $20 economic value. Calves, a male dairy calf, has a value of less than $200 in most places in the state. Goats, $75. So the DA's position is there ought to be some value that to raise it to a felony. And perhaps any theft of an agricultural product should be in a misdemeanor, and if you hit a certain value threshold, then it becomes a felony. And that would recognize the special needs of this group and still balance the interest that we have in not having every stolen apple case come through the door. Where that price point should be, I think, really should be worked out with the sponsors after they look at the fiscal. And there was one other issue in terms of calculating value. What I frequently see is someone will come in and steal a couple bales of hay, you know, $50, $60, $100 maybe. But they run across the producer's pipes to get there, and they drive across their field right after it's been irrigated, and they do thousands of dollars worth of damage. And our suggestion is that when we're calculating the value of the property or the theft, the producer should be able to include the loss to their farming operation. So if they steal $200 worth of hay, but they've cost the producer $1,000, that really ought to be a felony. And we're going to work with the sponsors of the bill to try to amend it to those extents. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Don, I would suggest from what I've, you know, my past history, what I used to do, that as crops become available in the spring, a lot of the stuff that's the theft, you don't think of much of a guy goading in a sack of peaches, and then the next week the tomatoes are ripe, they pick tomatoes, and it goes on and on and on. So the people that are doing that at the end of a season can just almost live off of a place. And the one that really comes to mind is Senator Cruz's farm, the way that's set up down there, 700 acres, a lot of it away from where people don't really see it. Let somebody off and you keep right on going. Come back in 15 minutes, they jump in and they're gone, and they got a month's groceries in the back of this car. It might be worth $400 or $500 to Cruz, you know. They may have to pay twice that for it in a store. So I think there's a lot more of it going on than they're used to. I think with our economy the way it is and people having a tough time, they're going to be looking at that type of thing more than they ever have before.
Okay.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm really interested in this area, and we spoke earlier together, and I don't know if this is something we're going to try to get done this session, or if there's going to be a work group during the session, or if we're going to work on it in the interim. I do think it's something to really pay attention to. Where we have, I'll use the metal theft, which I'm not intimately familiar with, but a little bit familiar with, as an example, and even some of the examples that are in the theft one statute now, that it appears where we depart from our $1,000, you know, whatever the financial limit is, financial threshold is, rule, is because there are additional damages beyond the beyond the strict dollar amount. Right, so with metal theft, it might be the replacement value, that, as Representative Barton just explained to me a moment ago, of some construction materials might be more than, because you have to buy it in bulk or whatever, than the value of what exactly was stolen, or because it slows down production at a construction site or whatever. And animals, you might imagine that young livestock is much more valuable as it gains pounds, right? And pets have sentimental value beyond their sort of sale value. It seems to me that we might think about those as a way of not just saying that X kind of theft is special just because it's special, but because there are elements of that specialness and we should specify that. And here are a few thoughts about that for the record. One, you mentioned damage to property. And I think if we thought about ag theft as having some elements, damage to property might be one of them. Listen, if I reach over a fence and steal an apple, I don't know if that should trigger theft one. But if I drive my truck to uproot a peach tree and put it in the flatbed and drive off, well, that might be, even if the value of peach tree is only $250.
He's the guy.
You know, that. Yeah. So I'll stop doing that now, in part because this would now be theft one. In the past, it hasn't deterred me at all. Second, related to that would be trespass. Third might be something like replacement value. If you steal some, you know, newly planted that going to be soon, you know, full blossoming, cheap now, expensive soon, those things might be like stealing a lamb that won't always be one, right? So. But I think we want to be specific about the elements as we think about this, so we have sort of a cognizable statute. Those are my thoughts.
In thinking about this, the bad economy, there's going to be less police out there probably to help patrol. And I know out west of my, where I live, but out around the Tualatin River near Hillsborough, where they have a lot of nurseries, I've seen huge fences they've had to build where they grew a lot of maples that were leaving. People are getting out there and stealing them. And so they have a huge investment in fences now. It's talk about cost of business. And I think Representative Krieger wanted to amend this for the bears that are eating his trees. Yeah, get those. But it does obviously need some work, and it's not ready to move without a fiscal today anyway, so it would be great if we could get that kind of narrowed down. I think we heard some great suggestions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have to think about, I realize, a second offense. You actually get someone doing it twice, then that needs to be elevated some way when you get us something.
Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3299. As far as the amendments, we're right now, as things are backing up, it's taking us somewhere close to 2 weeks, so we need to get that in really quick because we're running out of time. So it takes about 2 weeks to get the amendment and the fiscal run through. Thank you very much. I thought you were talking about something else. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2659.
House Bill 2659 permits reimbursement of law enforcement contracts, policy, and data review committee members' expenses. We do not yet have the fiscal.
Okay. So it's quite a referral to Ways and Means. I'm sorry, I can't read it. Annabelle?
Here. Aramia.
Mr. Chair.
Aramia.
Okay. Okay. Jump in here, too.
So. Hey, Representative Olson. Barton, get the questions ready.
Aramia.
See?
That's
yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Members, the double L is the Y sound. Okay. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, thank you. Yeah. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of House District 15. And House Bill 2659 is in front of you today at the request of the Benton County Commissioner Annabelle Jaramillo.
Jaramillo. But you're getting
the J is a Y sound.
Okay. Representative Annabelle. It's Commissioner Annabelle. That's my voice. But anyways, and I just want to give you a little bit of history of how we've gotten to here. The 2001 Oregon legislature adopted Senate Bill 415, of which encourages the collection of data on traffic stops by law enforcement agencies. It also provides limited assistance for the analysis of the data and establishes the law enforcement contacts policy and review committee. And that's what the commissioner is assigned to at this time. The 2007 Oregon legislature adopted House Bill 2102, which eliminates the sunset of the LECC, as it's known, which allows the Data Review Subcommittee to receive data from agencies that have not been collected. There are 10 members that are assigned to this committee, and if you take a look at the staff summary measure, which council did good, just an outstanding job of crafting, there's one sentence in there, and this is what the commissioner was interested in doing, was to make it permissive for members that participate in the LECC to be able to be reimbursed. And that's basically the language of where we were wanting to go through this bill. I'm going to stop at this time.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Olden said, I'm Benton County Commissioner Annabelle Jaramillo, and I serve as the Vice Chair of the Law Enforcement Contacts Policy and Data Review Committee. And in my testimony, I will refer to the committee as the LOC. I won't go into the background of the committee. Representative Olson has done that very well, and he has indicated to you that there are 10 to 11 members of the committee. Former Chief Justice Edwin Peterson is the chair, and I'm the vice chair. Current law prohibits citizen appointees from being reimbursed for their travel or other expenses directly related to their voluntary service on the LEC. This has created a hardship for some members who live long distances from Salem, sometimes committing the member to overnight and mileage expenses, or who must use vacation or unpaid leave from their employment to attend these meetings. Currently, all funding for the committee is provided by a federal grant, so any funds to reimburse travel expenses will come out of that grant, not from the state's general fund. Simply stated, the House Bill 2659 removes the prohibition for reimbursement of expenses. It does not say that members are entitled to compensation. It is permissive in that they would be reimbursed for actual and necessary travel expenses. My colleagues on the LEC and I urge the Judiciary Committee to recommend passage of this bill to the House and subsequent passage of the Senate. And I thank you for the time you're taking on this this matter, and I'll try to answer any questions you may have.
Anybody have any questions? Representative Stigler.
So there is currently no form of reimbursement in any way, shape, or form for these committee members?
Actually, the statute prohibits reimbursement.
Okay. And so there's no per diem or anything like that?
That's correct.
Gotcha.
Okay, thank you. We don't have a financial on this, but with the statement you made about it not being the state funds, I'm going to try and see if we can't get a letter so it doesn't need to go through Ways and Means so we can get it moving, but we'll check on that. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing, House Bill 2659, and open a work session on House Bill 2349.
House Bill 2349, we first heard on April 3rd, permitted a landowner who was in dispute with a contractor to file a surety bond with an escrow agent instead of the county recorder. However, as amended, it deleted that provision and instead clarifies that the owner's entitlement to interest earned on the surety bond and created a process for the county to follow in releasing the lien. We adopted the dash twos at the last meeting. We have a minimal expenditure impact, no revenue impact.
Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2349 as amended, that it be adopted. And there's no referral, right, on this one? Be adopted with a due pass.
Representative
Speaker moves House Bill 2349 as amended to the floor to do pass. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Would this fit the consent calendar? Any objection to that? Okay, the consent calendar. So we just stand these for a minute.
I think so. She's on her way over.
Yeah. The committee will stand these for a few minutes. So Representative Thatcher's on her way over. Committee back to order. I'm going to reopen House Bill 3218 for the purpose of allowing Representative Stiegler to change her vote. Won't change the outcome.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I know it won't change the outcome, but I'd like to change my vote to a no on 3218, not because of the concept, but because of other issues involved.
Representative Stiegler votes no on 3218. Let's stand at ease again. order and open a work session on House Bill 3071. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I just have some simple amendments that I believe make everybody happy, except there was a little slight misinterpretation by some people. I just want to make it very clear that the amendments for House Bill 3071 make it, it does not require DPSST to issue any certification or do anything for that matter unless they have direction from OUS to do that, from Oregon University System. If they decide to have a program offered to their campus security officers, I did not identify myself, I'm sorry. Kim Thatcher from Kaiser St. Paul Neuber, representative. So anyhow, it just gives them citation authority as set forth in ORS 133.055, and it just gives them a designation in the statutes as public safety officers, and what was the other one? It was just list them a couple of as public safety personnel. So it just it gives them a designation and allows them to have citation authority. So with that, I'll ask you. I'll answer
any questions. Today, you're asking for it to adopt the dash two amendments.
They would be the dash two amendments. Yes, sir. Can I?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Thatcher, just really quick, any extra anticipated costs with this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, there should be no extra costs involved with this, no, because there's absolutely no mandate for DPSST to issue any certification or for there to be a certification program at all. This would be something for Oregon University System to decide. And I brought up Mike Silver, who is with the union, to clarify any other questions you might have.
Smith?
Thank you, Chair. So I understand it's not through DPSST, but are there any additional requirements for training or expanded or heightened hiring standards that accord this increase in enforcement authority?
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, thank you for that question. No. Right now, you can keep in mind that there's a potential for them to violate people's civil rights by handcuffing them, and you can clarify while you're here. So this just would give them the authority to
SEIU member, and that's where I'll be speaking from, and I'll be drawing from my experience as a campus public safety officer. Chair Barker, Representative Smith, the answer to your question is it would not increase the training level or the standard level for hiring or maintaining certification or any type of certification at this time. However, this is a stepping stone towards that process in the future.
Is this the best follow-up? Is this the best first? It would seem like we'd want to do the training first and the power second, rather than the power first and the training second.
Chair Barker, Representative Smith. Ideally, this isn't the bill that's going to be the fix-all. This is the bill, given the economic times, speaking with the key stakeholders that would forth, that would provide the ORS and our campus communities the most professional and best able officers we can provide at this point.
Representative Stegler.
For either of you, clarification, because I'm looking at the fiscal on the dash two, and it's a very minimal. It says there's a one-time fiscal $21,500.5 compliance specialist. You're saying that doesn't apply, or that does apply? I'm confused.
Barker, members of the committee, to our knowledge, we don't know of a fiscal at this time. I believe that's still being worked on.
It's my understanding that there is not a, there shouldn't be a fiscal associated.
What am I looking at?
That it should be zero. That's my understanding.
Talk about the training or anything. Officers are doing, campus officers are doing these things now, except they are not allowed to issue a citation.
Chair Barker, that is correct.
We can arrest
people under probable cause authority. We can take people to jail, take away their freedoms and their liberties, but we can't issue a single citation for possession less than an ounce of marijuana or minor possession of alcohol.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you very much. What my intention would be today is to, if the committee so desires, adopt the dash two amendments, and then we'll set a hearing over till next Tuesday. Have some time to get everything answered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move the dash twos in the House Bill 3071.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash twos in House Bill 3071. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 3071. Carried to the 14th. Okay, open a work session on House Bill 3194.
House Bill 3194, first heard on April 3rd, includes prior juvenile adjudication for driving under the influence as a predicate for felony DUII enhancement. This has a minimal expenditure with no statement issued, no revenue impact.
Okay. That's what we're waiting for, was the revenue information. Yes, Representative Shields.
Could we have a little bit of discussion just to make sure I remember this this bill? Basically, what they were suggesting is that there was kind of an unintended quirk in the law that did not include juveniles as a prior offense. And our understanding is that that was not intended to ever be there. Is that counsel's impression?
Yeah.
I don't really recall a discussion about what the initial intent had been. It had been more that now that Clackamas County has developed a new program and a new way to deal with this, they, I think, are more in touch with the juvenile offenders, and they've seen now people with multiple offenses, and it's come to their attention now that even if a person has 2, 3, 4 offenses as a juvenile, when they become an adult and they get yet another DUII, they are not eligible. There's no predicates there for the felony offense. I think it was more a culmination of study and paying attention rather than going back to what the initial drafting had been. That's how I understood it.
It isn't a conviction, it's an adjudication, so it was a technical fix. If you're a juvenile, you're adjudicated, not convicted, and they wanted the drunk driving, if you have a drunk driving conviction to count.
I'll be fine with this, but doesn't it seem counterintuitive that there wouldn't be a fiscal impact on this, that if you had people who all of a sudden things were being counted against them from their past, that it might have some effect on whether or not they get incarcerated or jailed? Or
it would seem like that to me as well, although it would be out into the future somewhere probably, because it wouldn't be retroactive.
Okay, well, so I'm not interested in getting in the way of it. I just wanted to
flush
that out a little
thank
bit.
Thank you, Representative.
Good discussion. That's wrong at all.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barton.
I move House Bill 3194 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 3194 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye.
Representative Barton, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I do note that its companion bill was sent to the consent calendar. Just a thought.
Good try.
Keep thinking. Open a work session, House Bill 3263.
Wow. House Bill 3263 was first heard on April 1st. It extends the statute of limitations for certain sex crimes if the defendant is identified on the basis of a DNA sample. We have a fiscal impact statement on this. It's listed as indeterminate. There are numbers that are listed, and essentially after talking to Tim Walker, what he did was evaluate that in the event that someone is prosecuted as a result of this change, the severity of the sanction is such that he's estimated, you know, what the cost would be to put that person into prison, essentially. He, and I think it makes sense, he cannot tell the committee how many times this will actually affect into the future. So he just wanted to make sure everybody was aware of the cost of the sanction as far as the DOC is concerned, but it's considered indeterminate and does not have a subsequent referral.
And I don't know, I hope people had a chance to see the editorial in the Oregonian about this bill, where they highly encourage that the legislature do this, because it's a narrow group of offenders, but it's such a heinous crime that they don't believe people should be escaping that, as long as there's not only DNA evidence but enough proof beyond a reasonable doubt to convict. Even though the Oregonian endorsed, I still think it's a good idea.
That goes
for is it a shield?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, because I do think the Oregonian has written some things about Measure 11, too, that we might want to follow their lead on.
Not often they're
right. Every opportunity.
So I couldn't agree more about the severity of these offenses and how serious they are. In fact, that's why I submitted a bill that would increase sentences for rape one by 20 months. But I was just wondering if you all had discussed this with the Speaker's office. Or is everybody okay with this going through, even though it would most likely have some financial impact on our corrections budget?
I don't think we discussed that at length. We did talk about that bill coming up.
I spoke to, they are aware the bill was coming up. I spoke to Tim Walker, and Tim's take was that he did not have an official say, but he did not think that the fiscal people would be wanting it back to, in reevaluating it and looking at it further. I placed a call to Debbie Corsi in the Speaker's office and did not hear back yet.
And then last question, do we hear any testimony indicating that there were cases ready to go that where we had DNA evidence?
We did not.
Because I would think that this would affect.
They just talked about the fact that they had a recent rape with no suspect, and that someday they hope to find whoever that was. But there was no testimony at all about any of them located now, like that they knew of people who were outside the current statute of limitations.
Okay.
And then finally,
looking at the report on it, it says, it talks about the 6 years, but I seem to recall, I was only there for part of the testimony, I apologize, I had to go to full ways and means, but wasn't there some discussion about the 25-year statute of limitations?
And yes, then currently.
Last session we passed a compromise, it got us to the 25 years? Was that?
I was looking at some different statutes, I was a little surprised when they came in and didn't realize they had passed an additional statute last year having to do with the DNA, so I apologize for that mix-up in the SMS. If you like, we can carry it always a day for me to confirm with.
But I'll do that. We'll carry it over a day and just get the.
That would be great. Thank you.
Okay. Close the work session on.
Did we do?
We keep this up there.
Did we do this one? 2738.
That's 2730. You're on the right day. I don't have a 2730.
I have. Did we give? They didn't give me the right.
Okay, close
I
the work,
hate that
work
one
session on 3263, and we'll we're going to carry it for one day.
Okay.
No further business before the committee. Committee's adjourned. Thank you.